This is a security issue. It's not a trade issue. We have no reason to believe that there should be any reaction.
China accused of supporting cyber hacks. It's Monday, July 26th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online. We're at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Afghanistan still wants U.S. help. Empty seats at Tokyo Olympics. A different Olympic competition is held. Virus changes career paths. Hip-hop in Kashmir. It's all on today's VOA Asia. New Zealand's trade minister says he does not expect Chinese economic retaliation as tensions increase over claims of Chinese cyber hacking. China last week called on New Zealand to abandon its Cold War mentality after New Zealand's government criticized Beijing for supporting hacking following a cyber attack on tech giant Microsoft. Logging in securely from Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
New Zealand authorities said Monday they'd uncovered evidence of Chinese state-sponsored cyber attacks in New Zealand. Government officials said the Government Communications Security Bureau had established links between a group supported by Beijing called the Advanced Persistent Threat 40 and malicious cyber activity in New Zealand. Monday, the United States and other Western countries, including New Zealand and Australia, accused China of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email service used by companies around the world. New Zealand said such interference undermined global stability and security. China reacted angrily. Its embassy in Wellington issued a statement Tuesday, calling the hacking allegations totally groundless and irresponsible. It urged New Zealand to abandon the Cold War mentality. Business leaders in New Zealand are increasingly concerned that political tensions will affect lucrative China trade ties. However, Trade Minister Damien O'Connor told Radio New Zealand Thursday he wasn't expecting economic retaliation.
This is a security issue. It's not a trade issue. We have no reason to believe that there should be any reaction. If you're a small business, a big business, or you're a country and you have a huge reliance on any one market, then that exposes you. And that's why we're building trade agreements and trade connections with a whole range of markets so that our exporters and importers can have a range of options.
New Zealand, a country of 5 million people, is heavily reliant on China, its biggest trading partner. Two-way trade is worth more than $23 billion. Dairy and meat are key New Zealand exports to China, while coming the other way are electronics and machinery, which are significant imports. New Zealand relies on global trade. It was one of the first countries to promote the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a key regional accord. It was the first nation to secure a free trade agreement with Hong Kong. New Zealand is also part of the Five Eyes Intelligence Sharing Group, along with the United States, Britain, Canada, and Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We invite you to read more in our top story about cyber hacking by following us online. You'll find this and many other stories on our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. Find us as well on Facebook and at the voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. U.S. Defense Secretary heads to Southeast Asia. Typhoon may be latest challenge for already strange Tokyo Olympics. Floods may trigger production delays in China's iPhone city. British analyst envisions overthrow of China's Xi Jinping. Marsupial resurgence in outback China. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and so much more when you visit us at Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and at the voanews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We continue now with VOA Asia. Afghan lawmakers are asking the United States to continue to provide urgently needed maintenance and logistical support for their Air Force and National Armed Forces after the U.S. military completes its withdrawal in September. The White House has pledged continued support, but stopped short of promising continued maintenance or drone strikes on Taliban equipment. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain tells us more.
Amid ongoing violence in Afghanistan, including rockets landing near the presidential palace during prayers this week, the Taliban are calling for President Ashraf Ghani to step down as a condition for any negotiated political settlement. Asked about the comments Friday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki had this to say.
First, the president and the administration supports the leadership of the Afghan people, including Ashraf Ghani. The president was scheduled to speak with him today, I believe, and I don't believe there's a readout that's come out about that call quite yet. It may while we're speaking here. I would note that there are ongoing political negotiations and discussions that we certainly support between Afghan leaders, members of the Afghan government, and the Taliban. And we believe a political solution is the only outcome to lasting peace in Afghanistan. But we will continue to provide support to the government in the form of humanitarian support, security support, training, and we will also continue to encourage them to take a leading role in defending and protecting their own people.
Earlier this week at the Pentagon, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, gave this candid assessment of Afghanistan's uncertain future.
There's a possibility of a negotiated outcome that's still out there. There's a possibility of a complete Taliban takeover or a possibility of any number of other scenarios, breakdowns, warlordism, all kinds of other scenarios that are out there. We're monitoring very closely. I don't think the end game is yet written.
In a Zoom call with U.S. journalists Friday that was not recorded, several leading members of the Afghan parliament urgently called on the United States to continue providing critical funding, logistical support, and maintenance help for their security forces and Air Force, saying one-third of their planes are grounded due to maintenance issues. They also asked for more U.S. drones to attack Taliban equipment. Afghan lawmakers said the problems would only get worse after U.S. forces depart in September. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Still ahead, Tokyo Olympians celebrate victories without the cheers of the crowd. Happening now in Asia, more than 100 people have died and tens of thousands have been evacuated, according to Indian officials, after India's Maharashtra state was bombarded by monsoon rains, causing flooding and landslides. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's nice to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for tuning in. To the disappointment of many Olympic fans, spectators have been banned from attending Olympic and Paralympics games in Tokyo. That's in response to Japan's latest wave of COVID-19 infections. For VOA, Steve Ross joins us with reaction from Tokyo.
Games of the 32nd Olympiad in 2020 are awarded to the city of Tokyo.
Yeah! Joy from the Japanese delegation when the International Olympics Committee announced Tokyo had been picked to host the 2020 Olympics. Brand new sports venues, including a new national stadium, were built in anticipation of throngs of Olympic visitors. Officials saw the Games as an opportunity to promote the country's growing tourism industry and showcase omotenashi, Japanese-style hospitality. But the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted plans. The games were postponed a year, and in March, international spectators were banned. Earlier this month, in the face of rising infections, officials banned nearly all domestic spectators, too.
I think the reaction from the Japanese people, they haven't been supportive of the one-year postponement. And this has been ongoing for months, and there's been a lack of enthusiasm.
Professor of Public Diplomacy at Kyoto University of Foreign Studies, Nancy Snow, says athletes may be affected by competing in venues without spectators.
This will impact the athletes. They're human beings. They're exceptionally talented, but they're still human beings. They have emotions, and they're going to feel that. You got to have fans for the Olympics. You got to have that buildup. You got to have the cheering.
Even after years of promotion for the Tokyo Olympics, areas like the Asakusa District and Nakamise-dori Market aren't filled with tourists like they were before the pandemic. Visitors are sparse and local vendors are hurting, like Mika Soka Hanaishi, who teaches tea ceremony fundamentals.
I already lost 80% of the sales since last year. But obviously, I was expecting getting more, the time that the Olympics was open.
Despite their apprehensions about hosting the Olympics, the decision to forbid almost all spectators is seen by many Japanese residents as regrettable, even if necessary.
In terms of preventing spread of the pandemic, I think the choice to forbid spectators was the only way to open the Olympics.
Well, live performances are held with large audiences, so I think it's a little sad that no spectators will be allowed at the Olympics.
If these Olympics succeed, I think Japan's reputation will rise, but I wonder how much economic effect it will have, because we will have spent more money by then. I think we won't know whether it's good or bad until it's over.
Steve Ross for VOA News, Tokyo.
Be sure to read and see more on this story at our VOA Asia Facebook page.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Shanghai and coastal regions canceled all flights, slowed or suspended subway trains, and closed businesses as Typhoon Imphal made landfall Sunday. Central China is still reeling from record flooding that killed at least 58 and forced the relocation of more than a million people. You'll find this and all the big stories through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, the Olympics are apparently not only concentrated in Japan. 2 days before the start of the Tokyo Games, Native athletes gathered in Fairbanks, Alaska, to compete in the 60th World Eskimo Indian Olympics. Natasha Moskovaya has more on the unique events in much cooler weather compared to Japan.
In Fairbanks, Alaska, with a population of about 30,000, the World Eskimo Indian Olympics is a big event. It celebrates the skills and culture that helped the native population survive in harsh conditions for thousands of years. During opening ceremonies, a seal oil lamp was lit, similar to the ceremonial Olympic flame.
I'm Athabaskan, Koyukin, Tlingit, and Cherokee, and I've grown up around the native games. My third or fourth time on the blanket. I also compete in bench reach and Indian stick pull, as well as grease pole walk and ear pull.
The scissor broad jump tests the skill needed when jumping on ice floes. Greased pole walk mimics the balance challenge of crossing a creek on a slippery log. Alaskan haiki, one of the most challenging events, goes back to the Inuit signaling system. The ear pull's goal is to test the athlete's endurance for pain. And four-man carry is a test of strength that mimics a hunter carrying a heavy load for a long distance. Sean Hawkins has competed in the event for 10 years, but he got his first win this year. He carried four men weighing a total of 272 kilograms for 56 meters.
I'm happy, but I'm super shocked.
Eskimo Indian Olympics is an event that's been created to celebrate and to enjoy the long winter months that we've had so that we can come together, not only talk about how we've done as individuals, but to kind of show like how well we've kept in shape, especially when they're from places with no gyms, no other opportunities to work out. And a lot of these games allow people the opportunity to survive in life and death situations.
In the one-hand reach contest, an athlete needs to show incredible strength and focus, balancing on the palm or knuckles of one hand while reaching for a ball that is raised higher in each round. This year, Bernard Clark couldn't beat his own record of 180 centimeters.
I did on my knuckles, and then 72, I just... At that point, you know, you start to fatigue.
Some of the more unusual sports events are eating muktuk or whale blubber and dressing a fish. For that contest, participants need to bring their own ulu, a traditional knife.
Well, it's about tradition because mostly we're a community, and as a community, you want to lift each other up. And basically, the main purpose of the games was to also lift each other up because you don't want a fellow hunter to not feed their family because then they could starve.
There are no losers in this event, and those who didn't win were allowed to take the fish home for dinner.
Well, the goal of the games really are to test your skills because oftentimes when you're out at fish camp and you're harvesting salmon, you get hundreds at a time and you do need to be quick. And so I would say, like, my competition style cutting is not the same style cutting that I would do at fish camp.
The first day's contests lasting almost until midnight, mainly due to the native dance performances that the audience happily joined. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Making headlines in Asia, tax officials in India have raided the offices of two major media houses in what the press community believes may be a retaliatory response to recent coverage. Both media houses have been critical of the Indian government's response to a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, with virus lockdowns and precautions lasting well over a year, has it changed your outlook on life and perhaps altered your future plans? With the coronavirus pandemic easing in the United States, experts say an unprecedented number of people are choosing to quit their jobs. Dina Mitchell reports from Austin, Texas.
During the pandemic, Lipika Ramaswamy worked remotely in Texas as a data scientist for a company in San Francisco. She wanted to stay in Texas with her sister until things went back to normal. She's still waiting. In June, when her employer asked her to come back to the office, she resigned.
That, like, it's not like the pandemic is actually over. No one's declared it over. I don't know when the next wave is coming or if it is or if it's going to be bad, but, like, I'd rather just wait it out here with more space and around my family.
Ramaswamy found another job in her field, and her story is not unique. Nearly 4 million people, or 2.7% of the workforce, quit their jobs in April alone, according to the U.S. Labor Department, the highest one-month quit rate in the past 20 years. May and June have been only slightly lower. One expert, Anthony Klotz, predicted what he calls the Great Resignation from watching the quit rate over time.
Over the last decade, the number of resignations in the U.S. and the rate of resignations has slowly been climbing. And then in 2020, due to the pandemic, that completely leveled out. And so I thought there's probably a backlog of individuals who would have otherwise resigned from their jobs had it been a normal year, who were staying in place during the pandemic.
That's just one part of it. Klotz said accelerating the trend includes other factors such as burnout by frontline workers, a desire to keep working remotely, and reevaluating life priorities, or some combination of those. Kim Frankel left a 20-year career in education, most recently as a principal in California, to be closer to family in Tennessee, and because of burnout.
The role of being an educator over the last 15 months has been so insane, and responding to how to support kids and families, and then also supporting my staff, you know, like while they are trying to learn and figure out something totally new, it was all-consuming.
The stress of the pandemic led many to reconsider their priorities, said Andrea Vonnecker, the CEO of Sparks 5, a company that works with businesses to improve employee happiness.
It's almost like, well, if we only have X amount of time left to live, you know, how can I actually make sure that I'm on the right path doing what I truly love?
Companies are scrambling to decide how to react to workers wanting to stay remote. Employers are setting return dates for in-person work and revamping telework policies. Some, like Apple, are requiring a hybrid return to the office, with 3 days a week in person, expected to start in October. Ramaswamy's new employer, based outside San Diego, California, is totally remote.
A lot of us were living the city life just because there was no other option.
We're entering into an age of experimentation when it comes to work arrangements and adjustments by organizations. So organizational leaders are not just standing by saying, well, employees are going to resign, what can we do about it? They're talking to their employees, listening to their employees, and reacting.
The Great Resignation is likely to continue for months, with workers shuffling to new careers or companies. What's uncertain is how work culture will look when the pieces fall into place. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, Austin, Texas.
Kosher-nism, a hip-hop collective, is reviving conscious hip-hop music in Indian-administered Kashmir. The genre made its way in the disputed territory following an anti-Indian government uprising in 2010. The rappers continued to produce their songs up to 2016, but pressure from the Indian government, financial constraints, and a lack of opportunity forced the rappers to move to other places or find other work to earn their livelihood. We hear more from them in their own words.
My name is Mir Ghazanfar. I'm known with the stage name SXR. I'm from Kashmir. I'm part of the collective called Kershan Nizam. Almost a year ago, I, along with Ahmer, Tufail, Arslan, Kafila, we came up with this collective called Kershan Nizam. And the main reason behind this, step was, making people aware about what hip-hop actually is. Back in 2010, when hip-hop started in Kashmir, it was with the song I Protest, sung by the then teenager MC Cash, and that inspired many of the artists, including me, to start hip-hop, to start telling their stories. The artists who started making music in Kashmir, continued to produce their music till 2016. And then because of the lack of opportunity, because of the financial crisis, it stopped. It disappeared slowly. And then the silence of conscious hip-hop, ended in 2019 when one of my friends, Ahmed Javed, released his album Little Kid Big Dreams under the label Azadi Records.
Mara music is liye alag hai kyunki hum jo bhi likhte hain.
Syed Arsalan says our songs are different from others because we write what we see and experience every day. The songs that were produced post 2016 up to 2019 belong to an imaginary world where the rappers showed off their money, cars, and girls. All these things have become part of hip hop here.
Hip hop mein wo cheez aa gaya tha.
Tufail Nazir says, we must keep a lot of things in mind while writing the songs because the situation now is different from 2010. There are people watching. We have to think about our families and our future. Syed Arslan says, we don't see Kosher-nism as a group of only five members, but a collective of hundreds of rappers. People can come and join us and carry on our mission in our absence. That's our program for today. You've been listening to VOA Asia. Continue online. You'll find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Look us up under our name, VOA Asia. We also thank our service chief, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Amy Hybels, and Chris Cascao. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.